In the year 2525.
No, it's not the year 2525, it's season 6970, the fifth season in the Nine Row Chronicles, brought to you by the people behind CelticUnderground.net. This was a remarkable season, which, as you'll hear the podcast, there was almost an element of disappointment right at the very end because we didn't pick up our second European Cup. However, for those of us of a certain age, and I was born just after this season finished, the fact that we reached a second European final is quite remarkable, and we talk about that at some length in the podcast. We won the league, we won the League Cup, we didn't win the Scottish Cup, we lost in the final, we didn't win the European Cup, we lost in the final to Feyenoord, featuring a young Wim Jansen, but we did beat Leeds in the semi-final in what was referred to as the Battle of Britain in front of remarkable crowds at Hampden. Number one at the time of the league starting was the year 2525 that's playing underneath this, and number one when we played in the European Cup final was Spirit in the Sky by Norman Greenbaum, and that will be on at the end. We just missed out having back home the England World Cup squad song for the 1970 World Cup, and we just missed out prior to that All Kinds of Everything by future Irish president Dana. Anyway, enough of me. This is Robert, Lackey Moore and St Anthony discussing the fifth season of the Nine Row Chronicles, season 69-70. It's got to come and he ought to make it by then. Maybe he'll look around himself and say, guess it's time for the judgment day. In the year 8 by 10. So we are now entering season 5 of the incredible Nine in a Row Chronicles, and this is a remarkable almost there season where we reach another European final but lose, and picking up on comments of last week's podcast, we reach a Scottish Cup final and lose. So, but we obviously win the title. And first up, as we always do, we will talk about the League Cup campaign. So, first of all, Robert and George, did you manage to get to many games this season, the 69-70 season, as the world burst into colour TV?
Yeah, I did. I was finished college. I was back in Glasgow.
Robert,
I managed to get to a few games.
Yeah, I was at quite a lot. I was at some of the European games, some of the League Cup. I mean, I probably went to about 15 games maybe that season, not quite every week for the home matches, but I got to a lot. And, you know, this was a season with a lot of highs and a few lows. And but still a memorable season, an important season in the club's history.
So if we start off with the League Cup group section, again, we were in a group section with Rangers, and we were in with Raith Rovers and Airdrie. Poor Raith Rovers, having to come all the way from Fife to get to Airdrie, Celtic Park and Ibrox Stadium. So our games there were a 6-1 win over Airdrie, a 2-1 defeat to Rangers, a 5-0 victory over Raith Rovers, a 1-0 victory over Rangers, a 3-0 victory away to Airdrie, and a 5-2 against Raith Rovers. And from there, after a successful run in the group stages of the League Cup, we went on to play Aberdeen in the quarterfinals, where we drew 0-0 at Pittodrie, 1-2-1 at Celtic Park. Air United in the semi-finals, where we struggled to get past them. We drew 3 each in the first game, 1-2-1 the second game, and then St Johnson, victory over St Johnson in the final. So, George, memories of the League Cup campaign of 69-70?
I think it was most of the home games. So I do remember a lot of the games. I've a memory now. You could maybe check this out for me, right? I have this strong memory around that time that for some reason we went to a game in the afternoon, but for some reason Celtic were playing a reserve game at Airdrie in the evening. Now, I think it might have been this season. And we went there because Jimmy Johnson hadn't been playing, but I think he was playing for the reserves. And we watched the game in the afternoon, then we went through to Airdrie in the evening to see the reserves, and Dalglish was playing. And that was the first time I'd seen Dalglish. And remember thinking, he's a player. And I think it was that day, but I'm not absolutely sure. It was a curious thing to go to two games.
Well, all I know, just looking at the Celtic Wiki, is at that time it says Jimmy Johnson was still out in the cold. This is for Celtic beating Airdrie 6-1.
There you are. That might be it. I think he was playing for the reserves at Airdrie that evening. And we went through to see it. But as I say, it was the first time I'd seen Dalglish. And I thought, whoa, he can play. Now, the interesting thing, I remember the game at Ibrox when we lost 2-1. I think Baxter was playing. They had brought Baxter back. And they won 2-1, and they were all over themselves because they thought this was a resurgence again, you know, as they often do.
Pusachongs. Nothing changes with them.
Nothing changes. I think Willie Johnson, if I remember, Willie Johnson would have been their key player that day. But the big brouhaha was a Baxter coming back from Sunderland. And he was only a shadow of the player that had left. I mean, he was quite overweight, really.
13th of August, 1969, Rangers 2, Celtic 1, League Cup. The Celtic team was Fallon, Hay. Davy Hay made his debut at 19. Or made his Glasgow Derby debut, anyway, at the age of 19. Fallon, Hay, Gemmell, Murdoch, McNeil, Clark, Connolly, Hood, Wallace, Lennox, Hughes. The Rangers team was Neef, Johansson, Provan, Greg, McKinnon, Baxter, Johnson, Watson, Steen, Jardine, Pearson. Pearson and Johnson were the scorers. Harry Hood opened the scoring for Celtic after just 8 minutes. On the same day in the Reserve League Cup, which, again, to remind people, this wasn't like the Celtic Colts where nobody pays attention to it. The reserves had a bit of residence at the time and played at the same time as the first team. Celtic reserves beat Rangers reserves 5-0. The scorers were a friend of yours, St Anthony, Davidson with two.
Mm-hmm.
Friend of Fergus McCann, Luigi Macari with two. and Brogan scored the other goal.
As we talked about last week, the return match at Celtic Park was the Callaghan game.
Yeah.
So
Tommy Gemmell got the winner. Yeah.
So do you have any memories of that League Cup campaign, Robert?
Yes, I do. I was definitely at that Airdrie game 6-1. You know, my season had started a few days earlier where we played Leeds in a pre-season friendly at Parkhead, and 65,000 turned out for what was a very, very competitive pre-season game, which they always were in those days, unlike the type of fare that is served up these days in pre-season. And that had been a fantastic match against Leeds. It was a draw, one each. You know, we didn't realise we'd be playing them for much higher stakes 8 months later.
Robert,
I think, yes.
Robert, was that game not at Hampden?
No.
Are you sure?
We played Leeds the season before, pre-season at Hampden.
Right.
And lost 2-1. So the defeat at Ibrox that Lackey's just commented on put Rangers in the driving seat, and the expectation, of course, was that both Celtic and Rangers would take full points off Airdrie and Raith Rovers, and it would really come down to the two head-to-head. And the game at Parkhead against Rangers, again, it was a Wednesday night, huge crowd. So I remember Tommy Gemmell's diving header almost on the goal line, certainly inside the six-yard box after Gerry Neef had fumbled a cross. And that basically evened up the group. But then Rangers inexplicably drew 3-3 at home to Raith Rovers on the Saturday, and that handed the initiative to us. I think we would have won the group anyway on goal difference or goal average. But then, you know, the quarterfinals, I was at the Wednesday night game against Aberdeen. So the first leg had been 0-0 up at Pittodrie, and then we were a goal down against Aberdeen. I remember Jim Forrest scored, and this was an emerging Aberdeen team, as we were to find out later in the season. But we pulled out the bag, scored two goals to get us through into the semi-finals against Ali McLeod's Ayr United team. Now, Ali McLeod predicted, and he was even making predictions back in 1969, but he predicted that Ayr United would beat Celtic in the semi-final at Hampden. And he was very nearly correct.
Yeah.
The game went to extra time at 2-2. Ayr United then took the lead in extra time. And I think it was pretty late on before, I think Bertie Auld scored for a 3-3. And the match went to a replay, which Ayr United led in that game as well. And we turned around, Harry Hood scored. I can't remember who got the other goal, but we won 2-1.
Chalmers.
Stevie Chalmers. And this was Ronnie Simpson's last game for the club. He got injured, preventing an equaliser in the replay, and he had to go off, and Tommy Gemmell went in goals again, and as usual, got a clean sheet. And so we kind of struggled our way to the final, unlike the two treble-winning seasons where we'd won 10 straight games in the League Cup and we'd scored a barrel load of goals and it had all been very convincing. Less so this time, but in the final against a pretty decent St Johnstone team with guys like Henry Hall, Benny Rooney, Big John Connolly was an excellent striker. And the big kind of pre-match news for the League Cup final was that Tommy Gemmell had been
dropped,
left out. And he'd been dropped because he'd been sent off playing in the World Cup for Scotland against West Germany on the Wednesday night. And this was a game Scotland had to win to get to Mexico for the 1970 tournament. And I think the game was finally balanced at 2-2 at the time when Helmut Haller, who was a pretty famous German striker playing in Italian football at the time, he had a little neck at Tommy, and I think everybody's seen the footage of Tommy just charging after him and just towing him up the arse as hard as he could and you know, walking off before the referee even got anywhere near him. And, you know, Scotland lost the game. I think Bob Kelly, as usual, pretty unhappy with
Tommy
Gemmell's, you know, his actions and, you know, whether it brought some embarrassment to the club. And, you know, so we went into that cup final looking for our fifth League Cup in a row with a pretty unusual looking team. I think Davy Hay was at left back that day. Guys like Tommy Callaghan and Harry Hood were in for the first finals. And Bertie Auld scored in the first couple of minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the way it stayed. And I think the other thing which I recall, I think Stevie Chalmers broke his leg in that cup final. And, you know, we didn't see much of Stevie Chalmers after that in his last 18 months with the club. So five League Cups in a row, you know, in which we'd beaten Rangers in all five seasons. So it was, you know, we had done incredibly well. Nobody had ever done this in the League Cup before. And, of course, you could say the current team under Neil Lennon is now on four consecutive League Cups. But great memories. And, you know, first trophy in the bag by, I think, October or November.
I think, if I remember rightly, that was one of Jimmy Johnson's better games for Scotland against the Germans that night.
Yeah, he had scored very early on.
He played well.
He played well. It was a great Scotland team, Gilzean and Colin Steen up front, Eddie Gray.
Dennis Law.
Yeah, we had a chance, but it was one of these games I remember where both Billy McNeil and Ronnie McKinnon both played a double centre half up against Gerdy Muller and Saylor, and it was 3-2 against a team who went on to finish third in Mexico the following summer.
There's a nice story actually about the League Cup final against St Johnson, whereby Bob Rooney was Celtic's physio. I don't think he was a great physio by any manner of means, in the way that we have physios these days.
Yeah, I think a physio back then had a sponge and a bucket of water.
That's right. And Bob was a terrific servant to Celtic through the years in that role. And as Robert has alluded there, that Benny Rooney was, I think Benny was actually the captain of St Johnstone that afternoon. So what Celtic decided to do was they knew that Bob Rooney, his dad, would have mixed feelings about the game. Obviously, a Celtic employee, but when your son is captain in a team in a major cup final, there must be a feeling of enormous pride. So Celtic gave Bob Rooney the day off that day, and as much as he was able to sit in the stand and enjoy the occasion, rather than taking part as a Celtic employee, and always thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah, one of the things about that game as well that I'm reading on the Celtic wiki, so Simpson's injured, Gemmell's dropped, Clark, Connolly and Wallace are out, and Lennox has got an ankle injury, and obviously Chalmers breaks his leg in the game.
He was probably quite lucky that Bob Rooney wasn't in the bench that day, because he'd have tried to set it.
Well, I think Jimmy Johnson was on the bench for Celtic.
He did. Johnson came on for Chalmers when Chalmers broke his leg.
The other thing about the St Johnson final as well is it's regarded as one of John Fallon's better games, which George will be happy to hear about. Apparently there was a period in the game that St Johnson were on top, and Fallon made two or three great saves but kept them at bay.
St Johnson were a good team.
They were a good team.
Yeah, they'd drawn the first league game of the season at Celtic Park. They drew 2-2 and they were lucky. We were lucky to get a 2-2 draw that day.
Willie Orman was actually the St Johnstone manager at that time, and I think it was on the basis of his achievements, obviously, at St Johnstone that he got the Scotland job in the mid-70s.
That's right, because I think the season after this, or certainly for two or three seasons after this season, St Johnstone were the latest Scottish club to have some phenomenal results in Europe, and I remember they knocked out Hamburg from West Germany out of the Fair Cities Cup. And yeah, apart from the guys we've mentioned, there was John Lambie was in that St Johnson team, the kind of legendary Thistle manager. There was Kenny Aird, a little right winger who I think we had let go because we had Jinky, but he was a good player. And I'm not sure where they finished in the league that year, but I would imagine they would have been top six or something. Mm-hmm.
The other thing about the St Johnson game that's worth pointing out is Tommy Gemmell's relationship with Jock Steen was never the same after that. If you believe Tommy's account, then what happened was he turned up at the ground fully expecting to play, even though what had been on in the Wednesday night with the West German game, but it has to be said, Tommy was bang out of order for what he did. And it was only when the team was read out, maybe about 2:15, that Tommy realised that he was playing and he was raging, because he felt that Jock Steen should have been respectful enough to take him aside and say, listen, yeah, things are a wee bit hot after Wednesday night, I'm going to leave you, use a wee bit of psychology. But Davy Hagan, the number three shorts, and not long after that, Gemmell asked for a transfer, and I actually think Gemmell was in the transfer list for the best part of a year.
Well, he certainly withdrew the...
It's different in those days because the clubs held the contracts.
Yeah, I mean, he missed four games in total. Mm-hmm. And I think he must have patched things up in some way, because he ended up having a absolutely fantastic season. And he got 17 goals that season. Mm-hmm.
But the relationship with Steen was never the same after that, according to Tommy. It broke down at that point, so... And the clubs held the power in those days because there was no freedom of contract then. It meant that if the club wanted to retain you, then and you. So I think Gemmell basically just had to suck it up and go on with it. But but when you look at it, it's not that long before he leaves. He's only, for a guy who was still scoring goals in European Cup finals, he's not got long left in his Celtic career at that point.
I got the impression that quite a number of them, their relationship with Steen had begun to erode about that time, because I think they could see and he could see that he was going to change the team. He was bringing in talented younger players from outside, and I think a lot of them thought he was, my view was, I think a lot of them thought he was just, he wasn't very loyal to them.
Mm-hmm. Actually, when you hear and read interviews, it does seem to be the players either continue to love Steen or they have a real dislike for the way that he dealt with their, whatever stage they were at, whether they were, they never really quite make it. But any players at Celtic around that time, people like Jim Craig, Bertie Auld, you can see that they continue to love him forever. Yeah. But others, it's pretty clear that I think sometimes they even hold back on their criticism of him because they know the reverence within which he's held. But you get the impression there's quite a bit of animosity from some of them towards him.
Brian, I think it's a case of, it's the guys who lost their place in the team round about that point that if you like, spit the dummy out of you. But I mean, guys like John Fallon, for example, when Jock signed Evan Williams, that was the end of John Fallon to all intents and purposes. John Hughes had lost his place as the younger guys come through. Maybe so. These are the main critics of the Steen era. Whereas the guys like McNeil and Murdoch and Lennox and Johnson, who were more in terms of longevity, were in the team longer. They're less critical.
But it seems to be the way that he dealt with it.
Yeah,
that I think when you listen to them, and who was it? Who was it? His wife had the child and Steen never told him.
Yogi.
That's it. And it's the way that he deals with these personal issues that basically they all seem to say, all I wanted was for him to sit down and say, I'm really sorry, but this is the end. Uh-huh.
There's a number of those players that Steven mentions, you know, likes of Clark and Auld and Chalmers, they lost their places in the team, but that you never get that sense of animosity that one or two others had. So I don't think it was just about being left out of the team. I think, as you say, Harry, it was about the way he dealt with them at a human level. And some of them, I think, felt disrespected or undervalued. As in fact, some of them felt that they weren't just treated well at all.
But then I think it may be symptomatic of the way the managers dealt with people in general at the time. I mean, I've seen a few things about how if you were injured, managers didn't want an injured player hanging around, bringing other people down, because it was a much smaller squad system back then. And so if you were not playing or not injured, actually you were felt like a pariah that the manager didn't even want in the door of the club, across all clubs.
I mean, you know, Harry, that I follow the New England Patriots.
Yeah.
And their manager, Bill Belichick, is the most successful coach in NFL history. And he's brutal in the way he dispenses with players. You know, players who've been heroes, one day they're out the door the next day because he's determined they've outlived their usefulness.
But it's true that Steen had a bit of a cruel streak at times, because there's a story that John Hughes tells from around about this period where he turned up at Celtic Park for a game expecting to play, and he wasn't told he was dropped and he wasn't in the team, so he felt a wee bit embarrassed. And rather than go up and sit in the stand, he got a taxi home because obviously he was really disappointed. So a few weeks went by, he got back in the team, and Celtic went to Dundee, and John went up again to Dundee, fully expecting to play, and Steen read the team out, and Hughes wasn't playing, and he turned around to Hughes and says, "Try get a taxi back now, John." So there was a cruel streak and joke at times, and I think Big Yogi was quite sensitive to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I read something from Alex Ferguson many years ago, that one of the things he learnt from working with Steen was to be ruthless about player turnover, you know, and look at, you know, looking into players' eyes at the beginning of every season to see, have they still got the hunger?
Yeah.
You know, do they still want to succeed? No matter how much success they've had in the past, loyalty was limited.
He was ruthless as well.
You're always looking forward.
Yeah.
So Liverpool were terrific for that. You know, Liverpool, the Bob Paisley era, it was amazing the number of players that they dispensed with when you still thought they'd have a bit of football in them. And the irony was, when they moved on, their careers did they really continue in the same vein. So Paisley was absolutely phenomenal at knowing when the tank was running empty.
So that's a League Cup in the bag, but obviously we've got the League campaign, and the League campaign kicked off on the 30th of August 1969. The League that season, 18-team top flight, Celtic, Rangers, Hibs, Hearts, Dundee United, Dundee, Kilmarnock, Aberdeen, Morton, Dunfermline, Motherwell, Airdrie, St Johnson, Ayr United, St Mirren, Clyde, Raith Rovers and Partick Thistle. Those are the teams that made up the league. And we started the campaign at home to St Johnson, and we just discussed what a good St Johnson team it was. And actually, one of the things I'm starting to notice, the common theme in these 9-in-a-row chronicles is we don't seem to start the league campaign that well. This is the third season in a row where we start with a draw, a win and a loss in the first three games, because we drew at home to St Johnson, we won away to Kilmarnock 4-2, we lost away to Dunfermline 2-1, we lost at home to Hibs 2-1. So after four games, we were on 3 points.
Yes, we were 11th. We were 11th in the table after those four games.
And then, excuse me, and then we go to Ibrox. So I'm sure when we go to Ibrox on the 20th of September, having lost two and drawn one out of four games, there's going to be a bit of trepidation amongst the support. Going back to what I keep saying about if social media was around then, I'm sure everybody would have been, the end is nigh, we are going to get thumped here, this is going to be dreadful, we are going to lose. We go to Ibrox and win. So, George, do you have any recollections of that game? Celtic team that day was Fallon, Craig, Gemmell, Clark McNeil, Brogan, Johnson, Hood, Wallace, Hay and Lennox. Sorry?
Jim Craig got ordered off.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I remember that game graphically because Harry Hood scored that goal that's reminiscent of Lubo Moravchik's goal.
Yes.
He just turned them inside out and made them look stupid and then just raised his arm and walked away as if that's what I do. Just brilliant. I remember the day when they got ordered off, Craig got ordered off, and they were all there ferment at the time. And Steenett rearranged the team, and he put Hay right back. And I remember the look in Willie Johnson's face, as if, I think I've made a mistake here, because he had to play against David Hay, having got rid of Craig, and we never saw any more of him in the game at all. The one thing I do remember, that in the next day, again, it might have been John Rafferty, it might have been Glenn Gibbons, I'm not sure, but he commented on the fact that Jimmy Johnson ran riot in the latter stages of the game. The Celtic just gave him the ball and he kept the ball and he would just dribble past people. And it was almost as if against Baxter, he was paying him back for the cup final in 1963 when they tore us to shreds and he showboated throughout the last period of the game, and Jimmy Johnson tormented him that day. And I think John Rafferty said that the wiser Rangers defenders, for example Dave Smith, kept their distance but not Baxter. Mm-hmm. And it just tormented him, so they did. Mm-hmm. A really good win.
This was Jim Baxter's last game against Celtic in his career.
Well, Jimmy Johnson absolutely tore him to shreds. I mean, he was a shadow of the player he had been, but he didn't even have the wit to stay at the road.
I think that was the end of the line for Willie Johnson against Celtic as well, because there's a book, and I'm writing my brains here to think what book it is. It might be the Archie McPherson book that he did about Old Firm games. And some of the Celtic players allude to the fact that Johnson got up to no good that day to get Craig sent off. Mm-hmm. And maybe Craig fell into the trap a wee bit, but that's not the point. But afterwards, when they went to Scotland duty, the Celtic players were saying to Willie Johnson, Jockstein's raging, he says, you're forgetting it, you know. The next time we play against each other, you're going to be the guy who Davy Hay and Jim Brogan are lining up to basically do you. And the Celtic players are of the opinion that after that, Willie Johnson's... Because we've alluded to the fact that in the last couple of podcasts, Willie Johnson is a thorn in Celtic's flesh up to this point. He was a fantastic player. But if you look at the record books then after this, he did very little against Celtic. And the Celtic players of that period have gone on account as to say that they think it's down to the fact that you know, Johnson was a marked man at that point.
I think, did he not? I'm sure he played against us in the Scottish Cup, and he got involved with Craig again that day at the goal.
He did. I think Craig scored an own goal. I mean, I guess this was the Scottish Cup quarter final, and you know, Rangers went one up at Parkhead. Jim Craig scored an own goal, and both Willie Johnson and Colin Steen both ran up to Craig and ruffled his hair and gave him a pat on the back and congratulated him for the goal.
Yeah.
It may actually be after that incident. Yeah, Robert, I think you're right. I think it may actually be after that incident now that I think about it. But there was definitely something happened that season that the Celtic players told Johnson, you're a marked man.
Well, I think Willie Johnson had also been involved in the John Hughes incident with that we referred to in the League Cup game when Jim Callaghan, the referee, was suspended for 2 months by the SFA for not sending Yogi off.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we didn't really mention it, but John Hughes had already been booked in the first half in the League Cup game against Rangers. And Willie Johnson had a kick at him. And Big Yogi retaliated. And I think most observers, and looking at some of the reports, you know, Big Yogi should have walked. He should have been sent off. Mm-hmm. And Callaghan spoke to him at length and then didn't send him off. And, you know, that resulted in a protest from Rangers and letters to the SFA and Bob Kelly stepping down in protest from the SFA council. But, you know, Willie Johnson seemed to be at the centre of most of these tense moments in the Old Firm games. And as St Anthony just mentioned, the previous season, Willie Johnson had enjoyed great success against us. He was scoring goals against us on a regular basis, but I don't think he scored many after this season.
I mean, I'm not imagining that game at Ibrox when Craig went off and he went to right back. We never saw Willie Johnson again that afternoon. Because David, even as a young player, was an exceedingly hard fullback or midfield player, wherever he played. He was strong as a box and quick.
There's another interesting facet here as well, in as much as we didn't have a good start to the season, but neither did Rangers. And when it got to the autumn period, Davy White was a young manager and he was struggling against Dean, to be honest. And they get beat home and away with a team called Gornik for Poland, who had a player called Lubanski at the time, who, in honesty, was one of the best players in the world. But that was an embarrassing defeat home and away. And Davy White gets the sack, and in comes Willie Waddle. And I think Robert and George will be able to... add more to this, certainly more than me, but for what I can gather, Willie Waddle had been a journalist and had been very critical of Davy White, and then all of a sudden Davy White gets sacked and Waddle's made the manager. It's almost as if he was touting for the job. So I just wonder what your recollection of that is.
Well, he'd been the manager at Kilmarnock when they won the league title, so he had managerial experience. But he used to refer to him as the boy David, you know, quite dismissively.
Condescending.
Oh, aye, as if, you know, he's out his depth here. And I remember when Steen went to Italy to study under Herrera, so did Waddle. And the Daily Express in those days, they paid their fares for them both to go out to, prior to him coming to Celtic, was when he was with Hibs, and he was at Kilmarnock, and they went out to study Herrera's methods. So he had a pedigree as a manager, successful manager, and then he went to the papers and worked with the Daily Express. But he was very dismissive of White, who wasn't a Rangers man. As we know, it's important you have to be a Rangers man. You need to fit.
Well, I think the two games against Gornick, I don't think anybody appreciated in November 69 that Poland was also on the verge of producing, you know, a generation of fantastic players, which ended up flourishing at the 74 World Cup. Lubanski, as St. Anthony says, was one of them. But this was Rangers' first home defeat in Europe for about 6 years. And the fact that it was 6-2 on aggregate was deemed the final straw and the nail in the coffin for Davy White. As far, you know, because Celtic had made a bad start to the league, as Harry just outlined in the first four games, at the time when Davy White was fired, I think Celtic were more or less neck and neck on the same number of points, because we had also thrown away points at home to Hearts. Rangers had been beaten at home by Hibs in a game I remember vividly, where this very, very young, unknown Hibs winger, Peter Marinello, ran riot at Ibrox against a young left-back, Brian Herron, who ended up having a good career at Motherwell, but, you know, not at Ibrox. So, you know, both teams were more or less neck and neck. And, you know, Davy, as we discussed on previous podcasts, Davy White was doing okay against Big Jock in the league games, but doing pretty badly in the cup matches. But, you know, Rangers had spent the money. They had enough good players to mount a really serious challenge for the league. And in some respects, they stayed with Celtic well into the season. And although the margin at the end of the year, we won the league with 12-point gap, which under today's 3 points for a win, that would be a 20-point gap. So it was a landslide win for Celtic. But, you know, looking at Rangers' results, they only won one of their last eight league games. So they absolutely collapsed from about early March onwards. And, you know, we won very, very comfortably at the end of the day.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, I'll get on to the detail of the end of the league, our league season in a minute. But it's a Stevie Gerrard-esque collapse by Rangers. 28th of February, you know, they draw away to Hibs. 7th of March, they beat Motherwell at home. Then they lose to Raith Rovers, lose to Dunfermline, lose to Dundee, beat Hearts, lose to Airdrie, lose to Clyde, lose to Kilmarnock, lose to Morton. They lose their last four league games of the season. They lose, 7 of their last 8 league games that season. I mean, it's remarkable, actually, when you then look at the league table at the end, that principally, I mean, they lose 8 games in total. And a big chunk of that is the last few games of the season. I mean,
the other thing about that is we need to mention here is that was when Waddle took over at Rangers, that was the end of the line for Baxter. Because Waddle thought Baxter was, how can I put it, like a luxury that Rangers couldn't afford at that time. And I think he also felt he was a bad influence in the younger players with the drinking mentality that was going on. So it's actually quite sad in some respects, because I was a Govan boy and I used to pass by Jim Baxter's pub almost on a daily basis. And sometimes you would see him outside it, and he was actually a very pleasant man. And I remember my dad saying that's Slim Jim. And I'm looking at him and going, that big fat guy, Slim. But it's only when you see photos of him in his younger days at his peak, he was one of the greatest Scottish footballers of all time. But when he basically, Rangers let him go, that was the end of his career. And he was only 28, I'm sure. He might be 29, but he wasn't 30. He still had years in him if he had the mentality to keep on going. And I think as a football fan rather than a Celtic fan, there's something quite disappointing about that.
I think under any circumstances, you would say that the change of manager from Davy White to Willie Waddle just did not work. You know, as far as this season was concerned, there was no appreciable, you know, if anything, Rangers' form worsened under Waddle. And of course, Waddle became all-powerful at Ibrox, you know, for many, many years after that. So,
He took over on the 8th of December. They won the 13th, they won the 20th, they won the 27th, they won the 1st, they drew with us on the 3rd, won the 17th, won the 31st, won the 25th. So you're looking, thinking, right, okay, that change is working, they're winning all these games, and then it just collapses. It's just an incredible run, as I say, it's Stevie Gerrard-esque, is their run. But onto Celtic.
In the Cup in February. And that took the wind right out of their sails.
Mm-hmm.
Celtic really gubbed them in the cup match. It's a very hard-fought game.
And horrible weather that day.
Yeah, it was a horrible day. I think they had high hopes that they were going to do something. And I mean, that was mid-February. And I don't think they recovered from that.
There's some great footage and photographs of that day at Parkhead. I mean, Davy Hay scored from about 30 yards to make it 2-1, and then we kind of wrapped it up 3-1. But there was incidents in the match involving Alex McDonald and Jim Brogan, and Alex McDonald got sent off by Tiny Wotton, was the referee, and, you know, by some views, you know, Brogan should have been sent off. But that match was watched by the Fiorentina manager, because we were about to play Fiorentina in the European Cup quarter final about 10 days after the Old Firm Scottish Cup game. So the Fiorentina bloke, what he said after the Old Firm match, he says, "I am very worried. It was so tough. In Italy, at least 5 men would have been sent off." And then he added, "Whoever ventures into a wild circus such as Celtic Park has a right to be afraid."
I think, if I remember rightly, John Gregg, that was one of the days where he just kicked lumps out of Jimmy Johnson and really wasn't punished for it at all. Now, you know that one where there's a story about Jimmy Johnson saying to him, "Are you trying to intimidate me?" I don't know if you ever heard that one. Allegedly, Jimmy Johnson said to him at one point, "Are you trying to intimidate me?" Because he was putting him in the track that day in the cup. Mm-hmm. He got ordered off. He never got penalised. Mm-hmm. But Johnson was outstanding.
The point I always like to make in these podcasts is how the team changes without almost people noticing. Because Celtic keep on winning. We're winning games. We're winning trophies. So there's a wee evolution to the team. Now, at this point, and I think we've already mentioned, you've got Hay and Connolly becoming regulars in the team. Harry Hood and Tommy Callaghan are playing more games. Kenny Dalglish has made his league debut. But Evan Williams is, by this time, taking over as a goalkeeper for John Fallon. And there's a nice wee story about Evan signing for Celtic that I'd like to mention. He signed for Celtic on a certain day, and hadn't he made the newspapers? And I can't remember the parish, but Evan started playing football in the Boys' Guild in St. Pat's in Dumbarton. And there was a priest who was very, very helpful in the early days of his career to get him started. And Evan travelled out to the Chapel House and shut the door at 10 o'clock at night. And the old boy came to the door totally mystified that why Evan Williams should be on his doorstep at such a late hour. And Evan Williams says, "Father, I want you to know before anybody else knows that makes the papers, I've just signed for the Celtic and it's all down to you." And the old boy burst out green. Evan's greeting. It was a very emotional moment. Just think that's a nice story.
Well, Evan Williams signed for Celtic. And did he make his debut? No, he signed for Celtic on the same day that we played Ayr United in the League Cup semi-final. and played in goals for Celtic in the Glasgow Cup in victory against Clyde in October, on October 15th. And getting back to our run of league form after that atrocious start, then we beat Rangers. We lose in November to Hearts, but then we're winning virtually every game. We get to the 3rd of January, and again, as we've talked about on this podcast before, we're playing on a weekly basis, and then all of a sudden around the January Christmas, the New Year Christmas time, we play 27th of December, home to Thistle, 1st of January, away to Clyde, 3rd of January, home to Rangers, and we draw 0-0 with Rangers. And then we go on another winning run in the league until the 25th of March, where we lose at home to Aberdeen and draw away to Hearts. But that's in the period when Rangers are chucking everything away. And in the Scottish Cup, because you've talked about the Scottish Cup, that game, Sean Connery was at that Celtic Rangers game at Celtic Park in February, who at the time was the big James Bond, where he was about to come back as James Bond in Diamonds Are Forever, having stepped down for on Her Majesty's Secret Service. So he was the big star of the time. So the Scottish Cup run again. This is the other thing that I keep noticing. We are paranoid Celtic fans about the way that League Cup draws and hot balls. This must be the third season in a row where every single Scottish Cup tie that we play is played in Glasgow. We are at home to Dunfermline, at home to Dundee United, at home to Rangers. Obviously, then we're at Hampden for the semi-final against Dundee, and then the Hampden again for the final against Aberdeen. So, I think sometimes we need to rein in some of our paranoia, because we're at home all the time during this period in Scottish Cup ties.
Is that not a record, Harry, in as much as, I don't know if it tells you on the wiki, that I'm sure that is the only season perhaps whereby a team wins the cup without going outside Glasgow?
No, we did it the season before.
Did we do it before it as well?
And the season before
that.
We
did it in the Lisbon season.
Yeah, most of these ones that we've done, Celtic have played in Glasgow the whole Scottish Cup run. So, like I say, I think we can rein in some of our paranoia on that based on the Scottish Cup runs during this 9-0 period.
I think the Aberdeen game at Celtic Park when they lost 2-1 should have been a marker for Steve, because we knew we would be playing them later on in the Cup.
Well, we were supposed to win the league that night.
Yeah, that's right.
So I was at that game and we didn't win the league, and so then it rolled forward to Tynecastle on the next Saturday, where I think Big Tommy Gamble missed a penalty, actually, but you know, we got the 0-0, and that was the league wrapped up before the end of March, which was quite unusual in those days. But you're right, we'd had those two tough games against Aberdeen in the League Cup quarter-final, where we came out 2-1 ahead on aggregate. We'd been to Pittodrie in the league and won 3-2 in a very tight game. And then they came to Parkhead and beat us 2-1 in March.
Yeah.
And so there should have been no complacency ahead of the Scottish Cup final in April. There should have been no underestimation of Aberdeen's capabilities. They had players like Joe Harper, Jim Forrest, we've talked about on a few of these podcasts, Bobby Clark became an international goalkeeper, Martin Buchan was the captain,
George very young.
Arthur Graham, who I think was only about 17, he was from a Celtic mad family in Castlemilk, played against us. So they were a strong team, and they were a team that were on the up. And I think we found out that in the next two seasons they were going to be our principal challenger for the league title.
He was a very good manager.
And Eddie Turnbull he was a fantastic coach.
Eddie Turnbull had missed the final in 67 through illness.
That's right.
When Celtic beat them. But he was there for this final. And he was a good coach.
But you said last week, Harry, on the podcast, that trebles are hard to win because sometimes you know, your team just doesn't play well on the day. Sometimes it's a refereeing decision. So this Aberdeen Scottish Cup final was a treble for us. Obviously, it was a Saturday before the Leeds game at Hampden, so that was a distraction. But, you know, the referee was R.H. Davidson from Airdrie, Bobby Davidson. He was despised by the Celtic fans for many, many years, and this game was a big factor in why he was disliked so much. I have to say, my Scottish Cup final, I was in the north enclosure in the open bit. It was 108,000 there. My Scottish Cup final was nearly over after 10 minutes because I passed out when there was a big surge in the crowd, and I had to be carried out of the, you know, the terraces to get some air.
What age were you, Robert?
I think I was about 12 at the time. But I was a big lad, and, you know, I could, one of these guys was quite tall, so I could see well. But I think there was a lot of people, as was the case in those days, that a lot of people came in late to the north enclosure, and, you know, the match had already started, and there was a bit of a surge, and I just, yeah, saw stars in my eyes, and, you know, I was only being held up by the crowd. So I got taken out, you know, and after 5-10 minutes I was okay, and, you know, like a stupid idiot, I went straight back to the place that I'd been standing in previously. But I was back in time to see the penalty decision when, you know, I think the ball hit Bobby Murdoch on the shoulder, very, very high on his arm or the shoulder. Davidson gave a penalty, and Joe Harper stuck it away quite coolly. And even before half-time, Bobby Lennox got a goal disallowed after Clark dropped the ball at his feet and Bobby just poked it in.
Do you remember, Robert, there was an incident in a league game where Clark did the same thing and Lennox scored?
Yes.
It was suggested that he'd punched the ball out his hands, which he hadn't. He had been over Gallison the way he was trying to release the ball. But it came back to haunt us in the final, because when he dropped it again and Lennox scored, Davidson was very quick to give the free kick.
That's right. And then there was just before half-time, there was a strong penalty claim Bobby Lennox got brought down by Buchan and he didn't give it. And so, you know, as I remember, a lot of pressure from us, quite a lot of chances. And then I think 83 minutes, they got a breakaway goal. They had a young winger, Derek Mackay, who I think was from the Highlands.
He scored twice.
Yeah, he's pretty much unknown until he scored the only goal for Aberdeen in the quarterfinal. He got the only goal in the semi-final. And then he ends up with two goals in the final, both counter-attacks near the end. And I had a look at his details on Wiki. And, you know, he only scored one league goal in his professional career, but he got two goals against us in the Scottish Cup final. So he, you know, became immortal as far as Aberdeen fans were concerned. This was their first trophy for many, many years. And, you know, we had got the game back to 2-1. Bobby Lennox scored, like, with about 2 minutes left at 2-1. But then, you know, they wrapped it up again. So, you know, as I say, I don't think we could have underestimated them. We knew their capabilities. We knew Eddie Turnbull's capabilities. We might possibly have considered ourselves to be invincible at Hampden because we hadn't been beaten in our last 18 games at Hampden going into this fixture, going all the way back to that Kai Johansson replay game, which keeps cropping up in these conversations. And this match, this Aberdeen game, signified the end of our period of invincibility at Hampden, and we were to endure many painful cup final losses in the next few years.
The thing was, they beat Leeds United on April the 1st. Then I don't think they played again until they played Aberdeen. And that was on the 11th. And they were due to play Leeds on the Wednesday, cup following it. It's almost like they've caught in between the two Leeds games. They haven't played for over a week. And as we talked about last week, Harry was saying you need like a bad refereeing performance, a subpar performance, and your opponent to play well. And it was like a perfect storm because all that happened.
So, yeah, I think all happened. And I think, you know, a lot of the blame, it was convenient to blame Bobby Davidson and his performance on the day.
Yeah.
I don't think we'd played particularly well. I suspect we were distracted one way or another because of the Leeds game. And my other great memory of the game was leaving the ground after losing. There was a lot of disappointment. There was displays of anger around as well. But, you know, most of the more measured individuals around me were saying, well, today doesn't matter. It's all about Wednesday. It's all about Leeds. That's the one that counts.
Well, on what you guys are talking about, two things. The thing about the referee Davidson. So Jock Stein was fined £10 by the SFA. Well, to put it in context, that's a lot more money than £10 sounds today. But Eddie Turnbull, so he was fined £10. Eddie Turnbull was asked if Davidson's performance was that bad, and he replied, "Put it this way: if I had been in big Jock shoes, I'd have had £20 worth of a fine." So when the Aberdeen manager is saying that he'd have been twice as angry as Stein, then if he was Stein, then you know that there was something afoot there. Tommy Gemmell rather was booked when Aberdeen got their penalty for throwing the ball at the referee when they got their penalty. And also your point about the crowd there, Robert, because the remarkable thing about this is the size of the crowds. So obviously we're about to come on to the Leeds game, biggest crowd ever in UEFA's history. But there was 108,434 people at Hampden that day. So no wonder you got crushed. I mean, that was 8,000 more than attended the Chelsea-Leeds Cup final at Wembley. And, you know, there's a great bit in Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch where he's talking about the Hillsborough disaster, and he's talking about football fans for years, for decades, had gone and seen the police and their horses and assumed that somebody was in charge. And Hillsborough was the day that they realised it had just been luck that it had never happened before. And so with 108,000 people at Hampden, it is no wonder that you were involved in a crush going on. But we didn't.
And it was very costly because my mother decided that I wasn't going to the Leeds game on the Wednesday night.
Oh, hell.
So my sister Anne, my eldest sister Anne, she went to the first match of her life, and it was the Leeds game.
Can I say something just before we move on? For all Davidson was a thorn in our flesh, when he went on to him, I think, to the chairman at Airdrie, because he came from Airdrie, I'm sure his son signed for the Celtic.
He did. He was a goalkeeper.
I found that really odd, considering his relationship with us down the years, that his son should sign for the Celtic.
Bobby Davidson sent off Wee Jimmy three times in his career.
So
he was the kind of Hugh Dallas of his day. And, you know, when you think about the fact that the Rangers complained about Callaghan's performance and not sending off John Hughes, you know, if those kind of options and outcomes had been available to us under, you know, during the Hugh Dallas era, then some things might have turned out differently. But
secured that season, we retained the League Cup, we secured and retained the title in Scotland.
Brian, sorry, Harry, can I mention one thing here about the league? Just before we wrap up and going to the Europe, there's a performance that I always remember Celtic fans older than me referring to. It was a game against Dundee United, I think it was around about Christmas time. And Jimmy Johnson, by all accounts, or by some accounts, had the game of his life when we beat Dundee United 7-2. Now, I've heard first-hand accounts from people over there that day. And you think that performance that Jinky turned on, even against moderate opposition of Dundee United, eclipsed the Leeds games and the Red Star games and the cup finals in Lisbon. And they reckon that that might have been Jinky's greatest performance. And there's a nice wee story at the end of it. Davy Wilson had moved for Rangers to the United, a very good left winger. And at the end of that game, Davy Wilson stood at the side of the pitch and hugged Jimmy Johnson coming off the park and told him that it was the greatest performance he'd ever seen.
Yes, I was at that game. It was a Wednesday night game, yeah. Actually. And it might have been December. It was freezing.
December.
Fantastic performance. I think every podcast we have, we could probably talk about one of Jimmy Johnson's greatest displays for the club because he... but that was an exceptional performance. I don't think he even scored that night. But
he hit the post with a shot from 50 yards.
Oof.
50?
Yeah. So that was Johnson that night. People can, you know, at that time he was talked about being one of the best players in the world. Unstoppable.
It's interesting that he, you know, Davy Wilson was playing in the Scottish Cup final replay the night that the Celtic got humiliated. And I remember reading somewhere that Johnson had actually said to Greg at one point, "Our day will come."
Certainly did. Many of them.
So that season, we tie up the league with a 0-0 away to Hearts at Tynecastle. After we beat Hearts, we beat Motherwell 6-1 at Celtic Park. We beat Dundee 2-1 away. We beat St Mirren 3-2. Away, the only blemish in that campaign, really, domestically, is the 3-1 defeat in the Scottish Cup final to Rangers. To Aberdeen. So we then get on to the European Cup campaign. We'd, as you talked about at the beginning, Robert, we had pre-season friendlies. We drew away to St Etienne, who were becoming a force in European football. We played Carlisle. Losing 1-0, so it was a fringe team, and we drew one each with Leeds United, where the press were saying we need another one of these. Well, they got it. A European campaign, Basel, we drew 0-0 away and won 2-0 at Celtic Park. Then the next round must have been something where squeaky bum time would have been the order of the day, because we 1-3-0 at Celtic Park. So that must have been nice and tidy and safe. We're through to the next round, but we go to play Benfica away and we lose 3-0 away to Benfica. That must have been quite a shock to the system. And obviously there was a famous toss of the coin that gets us through. So
yes, I was at the Benfica game at Parkhead. It was a glamour draw. You know, Benfica had been in the final the previous year against Manchester United. Eusebio was maybe the greatest player in Europe at the time, and they had all these other fantastic players like Torres, the gigantic centre forward. Mario Caluna, Jose Augusto, all these guys were being stars in the 66 World Cup. And there was a lot of excitement. It was one of the last occasions when there was an 80,000 crowd at Parkhead, because the capacity dropped to 75,000 quite soon after that. So I was up the back of the Rangers end that night, and big Tommy Gemmell thrashed in a free kick in the first 2 minutes. It was fantastic. And I remember a full can of McEwen's Export emptying over my head in the, you know, the mad celebration. So I think my mother was looking at me very suspiciously when I got home that night, but I said nothing. And we thought the job was done after winning that game so convincingly. And but as we learned over the decades, you know, we quite often beat Portuguese teams at home and don't often do ourselves justice away. But we nearly made it. We conceded two goals before half-time in Lisbon. We were in a bit of trouble. And the clock was up to about 94 minutes when a free kick got lobbed into the box and they scored. And the strangest thing was that the referee, who was a Dutch guy, he immediately ran up the tunnel after the ball went in the net. And there was a bit of confusion. You know, had he allowed the goal? Was it now extra time? Had he blown for full time before the ball went into the net and therefore were Celtic through 3-2 on aggregate? And it was a couple of minutes before things were clarified that it had indeed been a goal and now there was going to be 30 minutes of extra time, which was subsequently played out with no further goals and we were down to this famous toss of a coin. So just reading one of Roger Bailey's books, he said it was now 12:30 local time in Lisbon. And in the referee's room was Big Billy, Jock Steen, Kaluna, the Benfica captain, their trainer, the ref, the two linesmen, and a representative from UEFA. And there was going to be two tosses of the coin. It was a Dutch guilder.
Yeah.
And there was going to be two tosses, and there had already been two tosses because there had been a toss of the coin at the start of the game, which Big Billy won, and then Mario Kaluna, he got the toss at the start of extra time. So in the referee's room, it was deemed to be Big Billy's turn again for the third toss of the evening, and Billy guessed heads, and he was correct. That then enabled Billy to have first choice on the fourth and final toss for the spin that would decide Celtic's fate. So Big Billy called heads again, and McNeil was quoted afterwards as saying, "The referee failed to catch the coin after he had spun it, and as it fell, it hit him on the foot, bounced against a wall, then rolled around the floor on its edge until it twisted down and came up heads. We were through." So, incredible story. Bob Kelly said afterwards, he said, "We do not approve of European ties being decided by a coin toss, and we shall press for changes in the rules. And perhaps our words will carry more weight because we have actually won this coin toss, but we object to it."
Robert, I did a wee bit of research for one of the books I was doing, and I discovered that the referee was actually out of order in one respect, because the rules at the time were that the referee had to go to the centre circle so that the crowd could see what was happening. And for whatever reason, I don't know if his bottle crashed because there was such a big crowd in Lisbon, and he maybe feared that if Benfica didn't win, he was going to cop it. But for whatever reason, he decides to hold this in a wee toty room, the referee's room, under the stand, when really what should have happened is they should all have been out on the pitch so that it's transparent for everybody to see. Because it took ages for the few Celtic fans that were there that night, it took ages for the news to be relayed that Celtic were through to get back to the fans who were sitting in the stand or standing in the terraces as it may have been. And this referee, by all accounts, went against the guidance that UEFA gave, in which case the toss of the coin should have taken place in the centre circle.
Interesting. I thought Jock Steen's quote afterwards, he was really unhappy. And he says, "It's the first time since I arrived at Parkhead that we have lost by three clear goals. It was a disgrace, carelessness that caused it, players trying to be too clever. And I was sick enough to pack in my job after we lost a three-goal lead."
Oof.
So he didn't. He did not clearly pack in his job.
So Robert clearly was
He was angry. He was very angry at the way the players had let it slip.
So Robert Kelly was very unhappy that they celebrated. He thought there was nothing to celebrate in winning a tie by a toss of a coin.
Well,
it was really a thing.
The celebration got us into the next round because we got the Italian champions.
Yeah.
For the second year in a row, we were drawn against Italian opposition in the quarterfinal, and this time with Fiorentina, with the ties to be played in in March 1970. Mm-hmm. And first leg was at Parkhead, and the I think Bertie Auld was brought back into the team. Bertie Auld had played quite infrequently during the season, but he did tend to play in quite a lot of the big games. And of course, his European experience was vital. And we won 3-0. Fantastic result to take to Florence. And in the away game, apparently again, a fantastic performance by Jimmy Johnson. He was the first player Steen went to at the end of the 90 minutes to congratulate after us progressing into the semi-finals. And so a 1-0 defeat. It was the first time a British team had beaten an Italian team over two legs in the European Cup. So quite an achievement. And Leeds in the semi.
There was an incident in that game where the referee penalised Gemmell for passing the ball back to the goalkeeper. So he passed the ball back to the goalkeeper gave it back, and then he passed it back to the goalkeeper gave it back, and when he passed it a third time, he gave a free kick, an indirect free kick against Gemmell for being too, I don't know what it was for. No one knew what it was for. There was no rule about not passing it back to the goalkeeper, but it seemed to annoy him.
I think that's the... Is that not... No, the incident... Evan Williams tells a great story that in the second leg in Florence, there was an indirect free kick, and the referee clearly signalled indirect, and the Fiorentina player crashed the ball right into the net. Now, clearly it's not a goal because it's indirect. And Evan actually stood out the way of the ball because he didn't want to deflect it into the net. I mean, so they're a bit mad, and they're all roaring, and obviously it was an indirect free kick, but at the end of the game, the referee stood at the side of the pitch for Evan Williams going off, and he complimented him on his rules, his knowledge of the rules of the game, because he had observed it was indirect. But when he got back into the dressing room, Jock Steen tore strips off him and told him, no matter if it's indirect or direct or whatever, you keep the ball out of that net.
The really? Other thing I meant to say about Jimmy Johnson's performance, and this came from one of the Archie McPherson books that I read many years ago, that there was a spell in the second half where wee Jimmy had the ball for about 25-30 seconds without anybody taking possession from him, which is quite incredible when you think about it, to hold on to the ball for that long.
I'll tell you how incredible it was. Do you remember the final when Real Madrid beat Eintracht Frankfurt?
Yes.
Well, Puskas scored four that night. And I remember my father was a referee in one of the training schools, training sessions they had. He'd only been in the ball for 70 seconds in the whole game. He scored four that night.
That's all you need.
That's all you need, you know. If Jimmy Johnson did it for 25 seconds, that shows you.
But Celtic got cheered off or applauded off the field by the crowd in Florence. And I think, you know, our superiority was appreciated by their fans. And I think their target had been to try and replicate what AC Milan had achieved against us 12 months earlier. But I think they just didn't have the lethal striker like Pratty to make that happen for them.
Celtic were a good team.
So we were drawn against Leeds, and I think there was quite a bit of disappointment when the draw was made. And when one looked at the other half of the draw, it was Feyenoord from Rotterdam against Legia Warsaw. And I think a lot of people had hoped that Celtic and Leeds would be kept apart and that it would be a great final. The final was obviously going to be at the San Siro. But of course, you know, the build-up to these Battle of Britain matches was just phenomenal. And the Leeds, the away game at Elland Road, I remember listening to on the radio. And, you know, we scored in the first minute and George Connolly with a kind of mishit shot. And we scored in the first minute of the second half when George Connolly scored again. But the goal was very curiously disallowed. But Celtic played brilliantly that night at Elland Road. Eddie Gray hit the bar for them. That was as close as they got. And so all roads lead to Hampden for the second leg on the 15th of April. And as Harry just said, the biggest crowd ever to attend a UEFA competition match in history. That crowd record still stands.
How was that the game? At Elland Road.
So tell us about it. Tell us about your experience, Lackey, of going down to Elland Road and watching Celtic beat the Don Revie's all-conquering, fantastic, better than everybody on the planet, Leeds United.
Well, I went down with my brother and a couple of other guys. I actually picked another guy up at Calder Park Zoo who was thumbing a lift. And we went down to the game and we were there quite early. And none of us, certainly my brother and I, didn't drink. So sort of hanging about a pub night was no great attraction for us at all. But we got there quite early and just tried to take in the atmosphere. But all the pubs were closed round about Elland Road. They were all barricaded up as if, you know, the Visigoths had arrived. Terrorised the place, you know. It was a Category A fixture or something. But, I mean, obviously Celtic played magnificently. But I remember as we were leaving the ground, a Leeds guy said, "Well, lad, you know, you team played well tonight. I bet that came as a surprise." And I said, "No." And he says, "Oh, come on. You didn't expect to beat Leeds United." And I said, "We've won this cup. You haven't." Mm-hmm. He just looked at us.
Celtic had 12 corners to Leeds 1. Celtic had 16 shots on goal to Leeds 6. The thing I find funniest about both ties is we're wearing white shorts in terms of the way the modern world is. We're wearing white shorts, they're wearing white shorts. We're wearing a white top with green hoops and they're wearing a white top. So to avoid any clash, we wear orange socks.
Why, they're folks. Leeds United provided the orange socks.
I think they were red, actually. I think they weren't the orange.
Oh, no, they were orange.
Think so?
Yes, they were definitely orange.
Because Jock Steen made a wee quip and he said, I think he was actually offered orange ones or blue ones. And he says, "No, we'll take the orange ones," he says, "because under the floodlights," he says, "it'll look like a tricolour and the fans will love it."
Well, exactly, but they were orange. They definitely were. But I think Leeds United provided them. Because I think it occurred to Celtic they were going to have to, you know, I mean, they didn't change the strips at Hampden. So why did they have to?
Well, Leeds played in red socks at Hampden.
Yeah, Leeds changed and changed socks at Hampden as well.
Yeah, which was normal for them in English games to play with red socks on occasions where teams had white socks as well.
Just one thing that I wanted to mention, a bit of context around Leeds had a fixture crisis at that time. They were going for the league. They were going for the European Cup. They were going for the FA Cup. And you've commented, Harry, a couple of times about our fixture congestion around, you know, the turn of the year. So Leeds played a league match on the 28th of March. They then played another league match 2 days later where they put out a complete second string side and lost 4-1 to Derby and they got fined for it.
Yeah.
They then played us on the 1st of April. They played another league game against West Ham the day after, on the 2nd of April. And they played another league game on the Saturday, the 4th of April. Astonishing that they played 5 matches in 8 days. I mean, it's incredible how that was allowed to occur, given the importance of these fixtures.
They also had to play a replay in the cup final, because they drew with Chelsea at Wembley and had to play a replay at Old Trafford.
The game at Wembley, was that not the game where Gary Sprake lost a really soft goal and cost them the game?
Yes. I went to a replay.
They should have won at Wembley, but Sprake had a howler late on and Chelsea got a draw.
Eddie Gray played very well at Airdrie, at Wembley. He played very well at Wembley.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what Don Revie did was he, you know, clearly he put out his best team against us, mm-hmm. and he rested them all for the, you know, from the Derby County match two days earlier, and none of them played. Mm. So, but on paper and in reality, what they were being asked to do by their own football association was nothing short of disgraceful.
It was, mm-hmm. In some ways, though, the opposite was the case for the Celtic, because I'm not sure the lack of competition towards the very end of the season helped Celtic.
Well, it definitely didn't in the final, because, yeah. you know, when we get to the final, yeah. I think one of the key factors is that we hadn't played a game, or the vast majority of the team hadn't played a meaningful game for 3 weeks.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And when one's looking for reasons as to why Celtic didn't turn up for the final against Feyenoord, one of the plausible explanations is that the players had lost their match sharpness.
They hadn't played since they played Leeds.
Yeah, there had been a meaningless league game at St Mirren.
Yeah, because we've already discussed they tied up the league on the 28th of March. The Scottish Cup final, again, we've discussed, was the 11th of April. We play Leeds on the 15th of April. One league game 3 days later against St Mirren. We play a friendly against Fraserburgh and win 7-0. And we play a friendly against Stenhouse Muir and win 8-0.
Yeah. Yeah, the Fraserburgh thing was a lifeboat thing, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Disaster.
Disaster. Yes.
Uh-huh. So on to the second leg, Lackey.
I was there.
I wasn't allowed to go. What was it like?
It was really good. It was, I mean, obviously the equaliser was a wee bit of a shock, but Celtic just took control of the game. They played really, really well. And as you know, Jimmy Johnson was in good form, but Bobby Murdoch was imperious, as was Bertie Auld. Bertie Auld knew how to play against these people. I mean, it seems sad to say this about a guy who just died a couple of days ago, but Norman Hunter, all these eulogies about Norman Hunter, he really was a thug when it came to playing football. He could play, but he was a dirty player. And Bertie Auld was prepared to take him on in spades and give him a very hard time of it that night.
I think in fairness to Norman Hunter, there was every team, to some degree, had a player like that in the team. I mean, when you look down in England, there was the likes of Tommy Smith at Liverpool, there was Peter Story at Arsenal, there was Mike Doyle at Man City, Nobby Stiles at Man U. Every team had a sort of like a, to put it euphemistically, like a ball winner who were really, they weren't the great players, but they were there for their physical presence.
Yeah. But you could also have a ball winner like Bobby Murdoch,
mm-hmm.
who was
a
far better player than any of the ones you mentioned, that was just mm-hmm. as hard as any of them. So mm-hmm. I don't accept that being brutal makes you an effective player. So, I mean, it's a shame this week the sort of guy died, but they're painting mm-hmm. a picture of him as if he was this great, he was a great footballer, I suppose, but he was brutal, really quite ruthless.
He was of his time.
He was, aye. But you didn't need to be like that.
Mm-hmm. So Lackey, one, what was it like being in such a huge crowd? And then two, how much of a downer was it when Billy Bremner scores after 14 minutes?
I said that was a shock, but when you once that goal went in, Celtic, they weren't fazed by it, really. They just sort of drew themselves together and started to play. And they dominated the game from then on. I mean, I don't really remember any great alarms when you thought, oh, we're going to lose this game. It was just a case of when will they score? Because Jimmy Johnson terrorised them in the right wing right up to half-time. And it was shortly after half-time, like, I think, not that long after half-time, he equalised. They played brilliantly that day. There's no question about it. And you know, John Hughes had a good record against Charlton. He played for the Scottish League against the English League, and I think he scored twice against Charlton, if my memory serves me well.
So, and he scored against England in the 1968 international.
Yes, probably.
Hamden with a bullet header.
Yes.
A one-each draw.
Mm-hmm. But he played in the middle that night, which sort of goes like, you know, everybody remembers him playing most of these games for Steam as a winger, but he didn't. Some key games, he was at centre forward, and he was very effective as a centre forward. One of my memories of the game is, I was there with my friend who had been at college with me, and his father was the head teacher at St. Bridget's Tory Glen, and a more urbane, civilised man you would never meet. He was a really lovely, quiet man. And at the end, he turned around and he says, "Champions of England! Champions of England! Stop you! You're the B-side." I remember thinking, God, I didn't expect that from you.
Well, you talked about Norman Hunter, Lackey. Norman Hunter says, "I played in a lot of European games for Leeds United. That Celtic side was the best I played against."
Yes.
And Tommy Gemmell said, "These games against Leeds were two of the easiest that I experienced in all the years I played in European football with Celtic."
But that was because we played well. It really was. See, there was a comment made by Jack Charlton when the draw was made. We'd drawn twice with them in friendly games, remember?
Yeah.
And he made some sort of comment about, well, you know, they were going to keep bringing us up there till we beat them, so this is a good opportunity, you know, to put it to bed once and for all. Almost as if we were boring playing against them. But Celtic were terrific. They really horsed them.
I think there's a criticism of Don Revy that comes in at this stage, and that some of the Leeds players have stated through the years that he could be quite obsessed by the opposition rather than focusing on the talents of his own players. Some of the Leeds players are of the opinion that but Jimmy Johnson and John Hughes, who were top players, some of the best players in Britain at the time, Murdoch and all, Gemmell, that he almost became obsessed with how Celtic played. I always compare that a wee bit to Jim McLean in the 1980s, when Dundee United used to get to the cup finals, and if he'd just let Dundee United go out and play, United would have won a few of the finals. But he became obsessed with tactics and stopping the opposition, and I think Revy fell into that feeling that night. If he'd just let his team go out and play in a normal fashion, they probably would have played better. But he became obsessed with Celtic.
Well, to be fair, he identified as liable to do some damage, did some serious damage. You know, I mean, when you watch Johnson playing against Hunter and Cooper and the footage that remains of it, they just were terrified from him. And he had done it to him in international games. If you remember, he played against England against Cooper, and he tormented the guy. Now, he was a marvellous attacking fullback, but I don't think he played against many people like Jimmy Johnson every week.
No.
Two other things I remember. When the tickets went on sale, there's a great photograph of the ticket sale for the Leeds game at Hampden. The tickets were sold at Parkhead, and it was on a Sunday when the sale was taking place, and there was 40,000 fans queued up that Sunday to buy tickets for the match. And the other memorable thing that I remember from the night and watching the match on television was the lap of honour at the end after beating Leeds at Hampden, and the euphoria was unbelievable. It really felt as if Celtic had won the European Cup again. You know, the noise of the crowd was astonishing, maybe what you would expect from a 136,000. But I think there was a real... we had played so well and we had won so convincingly that I think we thought the cup was in the bag, and that, you know, Feyenoord, who had won through against Legia Warsaw, were, you know, were not going to be good enough to stop us. And, you know, we'd just comprehensively knocked out the champions of both Italy and England by playing brilliant football. And surely we weren't going to lose to a bunch of newbies from Rotterdam.
I honestly felt that team, that season, was a better team than the team at Lisbon. That obviously the performance at Lisbon was fantastic, but I thought the team was a better team.
Mm.
And it was a real shock to lose. I thought there were certainties to win. Not because I was dismissing Bayern, but having seen the way they played, you just thought they're just going to win it again.
Well, the Celtic team for that night in the San Siro was Williams, Hay, Brogan, McNeil, Gemmell, Murdoch, Auld, Johnson, Lennox, Wallace, Hughes. Tommy Gemmell scores again in a European Cup final. He opens the scoring in the 29th minute. Feyenoord have a young guy called Wim Jansen in their side. Mm. And as everyone's touched on, the general sense of things is that Celtic won the European Cup by beating Leeds. Mm-hmm. And it was a formality. Lots of talk in all the TV programmes that I've seen since and the books that I've read since from the players themselves saying that Jock Steen was thorough in his preparation, but mentally the players thought they were already there, they'd won it. Tom Campbell says in his book, The Glory and the Dream, the serpent of complacency had entered Celtic Park. And Billy McNeil actually says that the defeat in 1970 took a lot out of the club and took a lot out of the self-belief and everything else. We never quite got back to that level again. Yeah. And there's a lot, when you read about it and you hear about it, there's a lot of a sense of that was the point where if we'd won that, we maybe could have gone on to further greatness, that players like Macari and Hay and Dalglish would have stayed at the club, and other young players coming through like McGrain would have developed onto a fantastic side of the mid to late 70s. But it went the other way.
But I think in the immediate aftermath of losing the final to Feyenoord, clearly there's a bit of a, you know, differing views being put forward as to why did we lose. And, you know, was there complacency on the part of the players? I think undoubtedly. There was certainly allegations that the players were far more focused on arranging commercial deals for themselves. They had an agent. They had a pool of money. Which they were earning, and they were overconfident. But why on earth should we be overconfident against a Feyenoord team that had knocked out AC Milan in an earlier round? Milan, who had beaten us and won the competition a year earlier. Feyenoord had barely conceded a goal in the whole tournament. You know, had we really done our homework on Feyenoord, was Jock complacent? Did he pick the wrong team, the wrong tactics? In the view of some players, and I think Bertie Auld was quite vociferous about this when all the autobiographies ultimately came out, was that leaving George Connolly out of the team cost us the game. And Connolly had played in the second leg in Florence, where Celtic controlled the Italians, and Connolly played in midfield in both games against Leeds alongside Bobby Murdoch and Bertie Auld, and that gave us a formidable midfield three. And that is, with hindsight, that's what was needed to compete against Feyenoord's own excellent midfield of Wim Jansen that we've just mentioned, Van Hanegem, who was about to become one of the stars of European football, and a very underrated Austrian guy, Franz Hassel. None of these guys we've heard of before the final, but we knew about them by the end of the game. They played us off the park.
How was that the game? I went to that game. And I wrote an article about it for the website years ago called The Shoot from Moscow. That's what it felt like. And the aftermath of the game. But I thought that was I remember on the night, it's not hindsight, thinking that was the poorest game I'd ever seen Bertie Auld play. I thought he never got to grips with Van Hanegem at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Bertie Auld's comment was they were outnumbered in midfield because George Connolly's sitting on the bench and Jockstein had put out four forwards, and Bertie Auld was of the view that it would have been a different game if it had been Murdoch, Auld and Connolly in midfield and playing with one less up front.
Yes, but I mean, I thought there was a point where Brogan got injured, not sufficiently to take him off, if you know what I mean. But it kind of hampered his effectiveness early in the game, not too long into the game. And Billy McNeil was never comfortable against Obi Kendall. He was a quick player, and like Pratty, and later on the Dutch guys that played against for Ajax and things like that, quick players exposed them.
I think Big Billy wasn't, you know, did not come out of that game smelling of roses.
Not at all.
I mean, the winning goal was obviously catastrophic. I mean, if he hadn't handled the ball, maybe Kinval wouldn't have been able to get to it and control it and put it away. And even for the first goal,
It was
a poor header by McNeil. Instead of heading it away for a corner, he headed it back into the middle of the penalty area, and you know, there was a bit of heady tennis before it got planked in the corner. But
I thought he could have actually let it go.
He would have needed a shout though to let it go.
Possibly, but I thought he was going out for a high kick. He headed it back in again.
But I think one of the problems for Steen was, who would he have dropped to make way for Connolly? You know, you're not going to drop Jinky. You probably wouldn't drop Willie Wallace, who had been the top scorer of that season, nor the, you know, ever reliable Bobby Lennox. Big Yogi, who had obviously missed out in Lisbon, had a fantastic season, nearly 20 goals for us. And I think that was Jock's dilemma. And maybe the easiest decision was to leave out Connolly.
Was it not the same team as played in the second leg against Leeds?
No, Connolly played.
Connolly was out.
Did Connolly play against Leeds at Hampden?
Oh, aye. Yeah.
Yes. I think Wallace or somebody missed out. Somebody missed out.
Yeah.
I mean, bear in mind, by this stage of the season, we'd lost Stevie Chalmers. Harry Hood had kind of faded out of the team.
Callaghan.
And even when George Connolly came on in San Siro, 7 minutes, he came on for Auld. And therefore, we still did not radically change the shape of the team.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not criticising Jockstein because, you know, we wouldn't be having these podcasts if it wasn't for Jockstein, and nothing in this era would have been possible without his man management and his tactical genius. But I think he was so proud of the manner in which we'd won in Lisbon that he wanted to do it again. He wanted to win with style, to play with four forwards, and I think at the end of the day, it was a mistake. It wasn't practical to play against a team like me who were quick and they were good in possession. And at the end of the day, we lost the final because they were better than us.
The Leeds game, Wallace had got injured in training, and so Wallace didn't play in the Leeds game, and Connolly played instead. So it was a bit to be, you know, if we're talking about choices, it was an enforced choice for him to play. You know, in terms of what Robert's talking about, the dilemma of who to leave out, he didn't have that dilemma for the Leeds game because Wallace was injured, and so it was easier decision to slot Connolly into the middle of the park, whereas with everybody fit, I suppose that's the thing that managers live and die by, these types of decisions, don't they?
I think he did underestimate Feyenoord. I mean, I've read in various books that when he came back, he thought they were not as good a team as Leeds United. And having beaten Leeds United, if we turned up, we would win. And we just never turned up.
I'd read also that, you know, in the concept of the difference that fans make, that when he'd gone to watch Feyenoord play, it had been in, you know, I think they'd been at an away, it was an away game or something like that, and there was only 7,000-8,000 people at the game, so there wasn't much atmosphere. And afterwards, I'd read somewhere that he said that that had an impact, that he hadn't appreciated the intensity with which that Feyenoord play, because there was no intensity to the feeling of the game when he'd gone and watched them.
Well, one of the things that, you know, having been at the game, that they had these horns that they blew, really, really loud horns. So the idea of, you know, trying to compete with the noise that they made by singing and doing the sort of things that Celtic supporters had done, you couldn't hear us. And also, we quieted the crowd very briefly by taking the lead. But when they let them equalise the game, they were up again making this incredible noise with the horns. And that was one of my big impressions of the game, was the noise that they made, and on into the night afterwards, because they'd won it.
Yeah, and we were not familiar with that. So if everything in Lisbon 3 years earlier had been brilliant sunshine, brilliant attacking football, with our fans singing their heads off, then it was the polar opposite.
It was.
In the San Siro. Mm-hmm. It was miserable weather. The Feyenoord fans were making all the klaxon horn sounds.
Aye.
And we had a miserable Celtic performance who really didn't get out of second gear.
You must have...
We left in Glasgow in baking sunshine. I'd never flown before. It was the first time I'd ever been in an aeroplane. And I was really looking forward to it. I'll tell you a story. I get pulled out when we're waiting to go through the gate. The special branch pulled me out. And they started questioning me about the fact that they said, they were looking at my passport and things. They said, what do you do? And I said, I'm a teacher. He says, you don't look like a teacher. And I says, well, I don't teach looking like this, because I had a big sombrero covered in Celtic stuff with a World War II rattle. You know those things we used to use? And a big banner, huge banner that the Home Economics Department he said, made for me. This giant banner. And he says, you don't look like a teacher. And the rest of the crowd get so annoyed at them, started shouting, leave the boy alone. So they let me through. And we got off the plane, it was bucketing. And it was freezing. Really awful. But going down into Milan, I had never flown before. I get this intense pain between my eyes. It must have been my sinuses or something. And I spent the whole day with this killer headache. Only to watch this performance in the evening. It was awful, truly awful.
You must have thought we were going to get a replay out of it, though, as extra time's ticking away.
And when Big John Hughes went through, I thought he was going to score. In extra time, he went right through, and the goalkeeper saved it. And that was the closest we got. But I kept thinking, if we get a replay, we'll win the replay, because we can't play this badly again. My abiding memory, the last strong memory I have of it, was after they scored, I was right opposite this electronic scoreboard, and it was flashing Kinval, 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 and I still have that memory to this day.
And afterwards
it was chaos at the airport. Everybody was in strike, and there was no programme. But in the airport afterwards, we were all taken into the departure lounge through customs and things. And then they said there were no planes. So we were kept there the whole day in Malpensa Airport from about 5 o'clock in the morning till about 8 o'clock that night. Nothing to eat. You know, it was... When the Celtic plane, the Celtic party comes through, and I was with my cousin, who was a priest, in Blackpool, in Fleetwood. And he told the parish priest he would have been back in time to say Mass, because we were out in a sort of 7 o'clock flight or something. And we thought we would be back. And he had to ask Harry Hood's wife, would she phone his parish priest to explain why he hadn't returned from Milan. It was an awful experience, truly awful experience.
Do you know, see in later years, I remember in the early 1970s getting an encyclopedia of football for Christmas. And it, as you do when you're a kid, you go through it with a fine tooth comb. Excuse me. And I came across 1970 European Cup final, final two, Celtic won. And I turned around to my dad and I said, "You never tell me we go to two European Cup finals." My dad never, very rarely in his life, spoke about that game. It was like the best way I can describe it is, it was like a dark family secret that was dirty. Yeah. And he spoke about Lisbon and he spoke about all these great games, even games that we didn't win. But he still found it too painful a memory in later years to even recall that in detail. Another thing as well is that has to be said here, there are stories, whether they're true or no, of the players having arguments about bonuses and payments and money before the game and distracted because of that. And the other thing is as well, and I genuinely can't mention the person because they've told me this in confidence, that somebody that I know of was at was in the Celtic squad, and the players were drinking the night before the final in the hotel rooms, and he will not go on record because he doesn't want to reopen old wounds, but he is adamant that Celtic players were drinking the night before that final.
Do you know, it's interesting you say, saying about the dark secret thing. I tend to gravitate towards facts that are counterintuitive or positions that are the opposite of the norm. And I remember sort of through the early to mid 80s, I started to get a real sympathy for the players who played in this final, when everything that the club and the fans talked about naturally was the 67 final. But considering that I'd started going to games in 73-4 and had no real clear memory of Celtic games until the late 70s. And so I'd not experienced the club playing at a decent level of European football. And so a bit like you, once I was aware that we played in this second European Cup final, I have always had a massive sympathy for the players who played in this final, for the lack of recognition they get, for their contribution to the club's history, for appearing in a second European final, European Cup final, in 3 years, and the club, for most of my life, have not even, you wouldn't even know that it happened, as you say, Saint. Certainly through the 80s, when every so often the Lisbon Lions would come on the field and get a standing ovation from the fans, nobody would mention this game.
No. Even this week, always there's an anniversary, but they're on about, you know, the Leeds game and what a great event that was. And I thought, well, how are we going to deal with the fact that we lost the final?
Well, to be fair, and it's a bit unfortunate, there was supposed to be a charity cycle ride with they were raising funds for the Celtic FC Foundation from Glasgow to Milan to celebrate the 50th anniversary of this game this year.
There was a thing recently, I don't know whose podcast it was, it might have been a Celtic State of Mind. There was a girl who was a Fyreard fan, and this is obviously their anniversary.
Yeah.
This is a great event for Fyreard. And they were actually trying to reach out to people to tell their stories about that final. And I think they were hoping to make some sort of connection with the Celtic support as well. And I thought it would have been a really nice thing to play a friendly against them.
The club did look into it, but just the timing of fixtures and things like that didn't work out. My brother and I drove to see Celtic play Dortmund in the, would it be 92? Was it 92? And I always remember I'd driven most of the way down to Hull, got the ferry from Hull to Rotterdam. I don't drink, my brother drinks. You know that way you do these things and you're not thinking about it? And we decided he would drive the first stage in Holland through into Germany. And as we're driving off the ferry, the police are pulling over the people who look like football fans to talk to them. And suddenly we thought, shit, he's driving the car. He was drinking last night.
and wound down the window. And of course, I'm on the police side of things, so I'm the non-drinker speaking to them because I'm in the passenger seat, but the policeman's there for Continental. And I then said, you know, what are you here for? And I said, we're going to the Celtic, see Celtic play Dortmund. Milan 1970, fire nerd, yes, yes, on you go. So he didn't get to smell my brother's breath, so we pulled over and swapped straight away. But yeah, obviously that's all they would think about.
For the 20th anniversary of fire nerd winning it, which would have been 10th anniversary, sorry, it would have been around about 1980, a Celtic side did go to fire nerd and play an unofficial game. Now, some of the Celtic players at that time, I'm thinking of the likes of maybe like Barry and Bobby Murdoch, weren't in a position to play a game of football at their age. So their places were taken by the likes of Tommy Callaghan and Andy Lynch. And it was Tommy Callaghan that told me that Celtic won that game. And it wasn't a serious game, you know what I mean? But it was played in a good spirit because, these people are hosts. And they're giving the Celtic players great hospitality. But he said that some of the players after the game couldn't help thinking we should have won that game. Even 10 years later, yeah, I know that it might be out of context because it's a long time, but it means that, we should have won that game. But you can't take it away for Feyenoord. They were by far the best team in the night.
They did play a friendly a couple of seasons later at Hampden, drew one each.
It was the following season. So we got drawn to play Ajax in the quarterfinal in 71, and Big Jock immediately arranged for Feyenoord to come to Hampden maybe in February sometime. I was at that match and there was a huge crowd at the match, and I think everybody thought Celtic would beat them 4-5-0, but it was one each. And I think we had not appreciated, what was happening in Dutch football. And, the Feyenoord coach, Ernst Happel, he was a bit of a genius. Like Steen, he won the European Cup about 12 years later with Hamburg as well. So very, very talented coach. And, I think I felt sorry for Evan Williams because, he had the game of his life in the San Siro. And until Fraser Foster's performance at Hampden in December just passed in the Betfred Cup final, I'd never seen a cup final where a Celtic goalkeeper has had to make so many great saves as Evan Williams did that night. And I just think, 50 years on, this is still a very, very sore loss. And there's some defeats that you just don't get over. Yeah. And this is one of them. And you can get over the Racing Club defeat in 67 because the game descended into farce. You can get over a defeat from Rangers because you're going to get another pop at them in a couple of months. But, when it comes to cup finals, European matches, I think the Feyenoord defeat is still, for me personally, even after 50 years, it's the one that hurts the most. And I think We failed to do what a lot of the great European teams achieved, which was to win it twice.
Yes.
So when you're looking at Madrid, Benfica, Ajax, Bayern, Liverpool, in more recent years, Barca, Real Madrid, we failed to do it. But as somebody mentioned, the achievement of reaching the final and the teams, the quality of the teams that we beat that year in our European run was something to be marvelled at.
I think that was the thing for me. I thought that would have placed them into the pantheon of truly great European teams if they'd won it again. You say, they were lucky to win it once, but no, if they'd won it twice, their place was secure. Do you know what I mean? It just was so painful. It was awful, really. That's the worst night, seriously, that I've ever had as a Celtic supporter. It was because our hopes were so high. I think that was the thing. Our hopes were so high. And the curious thing is that there seems to be a good relationship between Celtic and Feyenoord in terms of the fans and things. And yet we don't have any relationship with Ajax. Mm-hmm. It just caused trouble every time they come. And I don't know what that's about. I don't know whether it's to do with the Rangers connection with former Ajax players playing for them. But, you know, we've got the relationship with Henrik played for them, and Wim Jansen was a great player, our manager. There seems to be the potential there for a link. Despite
Reggie Blinker.
Well, even Pierre ended up playing for them.
Yeah, he did. Against Rangers. They invited us twice in the 80s to play in their pre-season tournament, which we won it 1 year against Dukla Prague, you know, which was another old connection. Yeah. But I think those would have been kind of early mid-80s. And I think fair play to Feyenoord. They had the better tactics. They had the better players on the day. And, you know, Ajax came along and won the next three trophies. So Dutch football was on a high. And, you know, what you say, St. Anthony, about the players drinking, you know, just supports the view that there was a complacency, you know, that we just had to turn up and we were going to win the European Cup again. And it's, you know, that lesson was learnt in the harshest possible terms.
So that's the season 69-70. And conscious of the fact that each one's getting longer, so if we carry on at this rate, the final nine in a row season will be 3 hours long. So so that's 69-70. Next season is 70-71, which, again, another title for Celtic, but some dark days for Scottish football domestically in that, and we'll cover that. I always have to touch off on the highs and lows of the films. The films, and I know this breaches across the 70-70 and into the 70-71 season, but the films at the box office, number 10 was The Aristocats, a Disney film. Number 9, Chariots of the Gods. Number 8, Tora, Tora, Tora. Number 7, Ryan's Daughter. 6, Little Big Man. 5, Woodstock. 4, Patton. 3, MASH. 2, Airport. And number 1, Love Story.
There you are, eh?
So there's the films of the time. That was Celtic. We almost did it. We won the Glasgow Cup. We won the League Cup. We won the league. We got to European Cup final and we got to the Scottish Cup final. It could have been another remarkable 67 season. It wasn't. But we'll move on to 70-71 next time, and I'll say, gents, thanks very much. So next season we're going to have the first season that happened, not that it really matters to anyone, the first season that happened when I was alive. And when Eddie Pearson from our site was alive. So there you go. Puts us both in the 50-year-old age bracket coming up this year. Not that we'll have much going on our birthdays, but the looks of things. Anyway, enough of me. One thing I will say is, for those of you who haven't noticed already, if you go on our website, you will see that we have a jersey from the 2003-04 season signed by Henrik Larsson, available for sale on the eBay site. The bidding process expires on Monday, Monday the 20th, I think it is. Every single penny of the proceeds from this, the only cost that will not be, that you'll pay, that's not going to the Celtic Foundation, is the postage. So every single penny from this is going directly to the Celtic FC Foundation, to their Football for Good campaign, which at the moment is feeding NHS staff at the Cathedral Hotel next to the Royal Infirmary. So, fantastic gesture for the person who gave us that signed Henrik Larsson jersey to auction for zero cost, and to allow all the money to go to the Celtic Foundation. So if you go on our website, you'll see the link to the eBay page that you can bid if that's the way you are, if you're in the fortunate position to have some funds that you can spare at this time. Anyway, enough of me. Season 6 is next. This is me, Harry Brady. That was St. Anthony, Lackey Moore and Robert saying goodnight, God bless, take care, look after yourselves. Good night.